It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. If you're working for the federal minimum wage full-time, affording a two-bedroom home in the U.S. on less than a third of your monthly income is not possible. It's likely out of your price range. It may cost more than you can afford. That's according to a study released this month called Out of Reach. Dan Threet is the lead research analyst for this project. In America, Dan, on average, how much does someone working full-time have to earn in wages to afford a one-bedroom apartment?
Someone working full-time would need to earn $20.40 an hour in order to be able to afford a modest one-bedroom apartment in their area. Supposing you have dependents or a family, you need a little space, you'd need to earn $24.90 an hour to afford a two-bedroom.
When you're talking about affording a two-bedroom apartment, I mean, this includes adjustments for state minimum wages, correct? I mean, for example, in Pennsylvania, it's $7.25 an hour, just like the federal minimum. But in neighboring West Virginia, it's $8.75 an hour. So how do those different state minimums fit into the calculations for this report?
So even taking those higher wages on board, there is nowhere in America where a full-time minimum wage worker earning the minimum wage for their area can afford a two-bedroom home at the fair market rent. And in the vast majority of places across the country, 93% of all counties nationwide, a full-time minimum wage worker earning the minimum wage for their area cannot afford a one-bedroom either.
How did your organization, the National Low Income Housing Coalition, collect the data for this report? Because you are talking about so many different states.
Our key statistic is something we call the housing wage, right, which we've just been talking about. It represents what a full-time worker needs to earn every hour in order to afford rent and utilities at something called fair market rent. Mm-hmm. Fair market rents are set by the Department of Housing and Urban Development each year, and they look at American Community Survey data to get a sense of how much people are actually paying for rent and utilities in their community. And they adjust that slightly each year.
How does housing wage compare to another wage we've heard of? Of course, the minimum wage, but the living wage, which is the amount to provide adequate food, shelter, and other necessities.
It depends on how you would cash out a living wage, what you would put into that basket. So the housing wage is built on an affordability standard that says that a household shouldn't spend more than 30% of their income on housing costs. If they spend more than that, they're considered housing cost burdened. If someone can find affordable housing, it may be the case that they can afford those other basic needs as well. We certainly have a lot of evidence that, especially for low-income renters, when they are cost-burdened, when they spend more than 30% of their income on rent, they wind up having to cut back on other basic needs like food, healthcare. So these things go hand in hand.
So this report focuses on people renting one- and two-bedroom housing units. A lot of people have partners or roommates sharing the cost. How does that impact your calculations?
One of the things that we found when looking at 2019 data, the latest data available, is that about 47% of renter households have just one adult. And even among those that have more than one adult, not all of them have two full-time wage earners. I think the last time I checked, on average, when we're looking at households that have two adults and at least one child, they're working less than 80 hours a week, all told. We made the assumption that we start with one income earner for a couple of reasons. One, to make sure that we don't miss out on the millions of renter households who only have one adult, one head of household, one person in the workforce. But also, I think there's a normative commitment there, right? That one job should be sufficient for those who can work to be able to afford a decently priced home.
In the Pittsburgh area, the annual income needed to rent a one-bedroom house is about $31,000. How does that compare to other parts of the country?
So Pittsburgh is a little cheaper than some other parts of the country. The one-bedroom housing wage in the Pittsburgh metro is $14.85 an hour, and the two-bedroom housing wage in the Pittsburgh metro is $18.08 an hour. So there are some respects in which it looks more affordable, but I think the thing to bear in mind is that it's not just the sticker shock of the sheer cost of rent, but the shortfall between wages and rent that matter. So obviously someone working at the minimum wage of $7.25 an hour can't afford either of those. It's also the case, though, that the average renter in the Pittsburgh metro makes $16.32 an hour. That's sufficient to afford a one-bedroom, but not a two-bedroom at the fair market rent.
If someone is working for the federal minimum wage in Pittsburgh, which is the same as the state minimum wage, according to your report, they can't work a maximum of 40 hours a week and still be able to afford to spend a maximum of 30% of their income on housing. So what kind of impact does having to work 60, 70, 80 hours a week have on renters just to pay their housing bills?
We do estimate that this year, someone working the minimum wage in the Pittsburgh area would need to work 82 hours every week all year round to be able to afford a one-bedroom, or 100 hours a week to be able to afford a two-bedroom. And I think there's one respect in which that is a very unrealistic assumption, to assume that someone could work that many hours every week, 52 weeks a year. We're talking about people not having time to take care of their family, not having time to even commute to these jobs in some circumstances. So there are many ways in which this would have very harmful impacts on the well-being of people who are put in this circumstance. And that's assuming they can actually get jobs that would allow them to cobble together 80 or 100 hours a week.
We know that people of color earn less on average than white workers. How do these wage differences impact those folks?
For the median white worker, they can afford the national average for a one-bedroom rental home, but the median Black worker and the median Latino worker cannot. That income inequality by race and ethnicity, I think, starts to help to explain why it is that Black households and Latino households are much more likely than white households to be housing cost burdened, to be spending more than 30% of their income on their housing costs. Mm-hmm. That has reverberating consequences for those households as they have to make those kinds of really serious cutbacks to other basic needs.
How's the pandemic impacted your study?
The report this year draws on the latest data available, which date mostly from 2019. So the report can be said to help give us a robust picture of the inadequacy of the pre-pandemic status quo. There are still a lot of open questions about how renters have fared during the pandemic. And we've written a bit on this at the Coalition. We've seen some data from the Census Bureau that suggests that as of early July, there are about 6.5 million renter households who are currently not caught up on rent. Right now, there is an eviction moratorium issued by the CDC that's ending this weekend. And so many of those households in the next few months may be looking at eviction. We've also seen some data over the last year and a half now about where rents have fallen in some areas. So you might have seen some headlines about the median rent in expensive metros like San Francisco and New York falling. But a decrease in the median rent in some of those cities does not necessarily translate into greater affordability for the lowest income renters. At the upper end, those luxury units, which were occupied by higher income renters, were vacated. And as vacancies rose, the rents fell. But at the bottom end of the market, we actually saw greater competition for affordable units. This makes sense. As households are in greater financial stress, they might look for more affordable options. So for the lower income renters, they might actually be seeing a greater struggle to afford their homes since the beginning of the pandemic.
Dan Threet is the lead research analyst for the National Low-Income Housing Coalition's Out of Reach study on minimum wage and housing costs. Dan, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The city of Pittsburgh plans to use half of the $335 million in federal recovery assistance to offset lost revenues and avoid laying off hundreds of city workers. But what might be the long-term impacts to other local governments? Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh Institute of Politics Fiscal Policy and Governance Committee surveyed municipalities in 10 counties across southwestern Pennsylvania about what they've lost and have published their findings. Aaron Lauer is a senior policy analyst and author of the report. Aaron, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
Aaron, How much revenue did state and local governments lose due to the pandemic and the recession?
So at this time, projections are looking at about $300 billion lost nationally for state and local governments. And there's also a potential ripple effect coming out of some economic trends that occurred during the pandemic, like remote work and greater online shopping and takeout, which could have implications for the value of commercial real estate and in turn for property tax revenues within the region.
And I assume parking taxes, gas taxes, other such in terms of revenue that municipalities would have gotten.
Yes, certainly there's been a downturn also in those sorts of revenue sources. They've come from things like commuting or in-person entertainment and dining. And so you've seen across the region drops within those revenue sources like liquid fuels and parking fees. And so, for instance, in the city of Pittsburgh, they've actually seen a 45% decrease in the amount of parking revenue that they've received from 2019 to 2020.
Early in the pandemic, I spoke with David Miller, then the director of the Center for Metropolitan Studies. He told us that their projections indicated, now this was more than a year ago, that 20% of more than 500 municipal governments in southwestern Pennsylvania might not have sufficient revenues by the end of 2021 to continue operations. Now that you have more data to go on, overall, what would you say is the situation for the towns and boroughs and small cities in our region?
And so those initial projections turned out to be a little bit more extreme than what ended up resulting. And so you have approximately 70% of municipalities and school districts within the region have seen a sort of a 5% increase or decrease in their earned income tax revenues over the course of 2019 to 2020. However, that isn't to say that there aren't municipalities that were not impacted severely. And so looking at these municipalities that have lost more than 20% of their revenue, they tend to be concentrated in Washington and Greene counties. And this may have something to do with other economic trends going on, like the slowdown in natural gas development within those regions.
City of Pittsburgh used more than half of its $120 million in reserves. Obviously, the smaller municipalities have much, much less in savings. Did you find anything about how much they had to tap their reserves, their rainy day funds?
We did not get into their rainy day funds, but certainly the pandemic has stretched many of these municipalities to the brink and will continue to impact them over the coming years. Thankfully, the federal government has stepped up through the CARES Act and more recently through the American Rescue Plan. And these two bills have provided critical funding to municipalities so that they continue their operations.
Mm-hmm. One thing mentioned in your report is a hope to use the federal COVID relief money to create long-term benefits. This is one-time money, the rescue plan. So how might that work?
And so the rescue plan offers a unique opportunity for municipalities in the region. And so there's four allowable uses, and in terms of our survey, the vast majority of municipalities are looking at opportunities around replacing lost revenue, working on economic development in terms of their local businesses and nonprofits, and also investing in critical infrastructure. And so they have the opportunity to use these funds to catalyze economic development within their communities, and hopefully that will improve their opportunities for longer-term revenues and municipal services going forward.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, What are some recommendations that you hope municipalities adopt to help shore up their local economies?
And so our committee identified four sets of recommendations. And so we're looking for practice change on the local level and also policy change on the more the county and state level. And so the recommendations fall into increasing municipal revenue flexibility, improving local government financial capacity and transparency, promoting basic government administration and budgeting standards, and improving supports for intergovernmental cooperation between municipalities.
Mm-hmm. We have about 90 seconds left. Do your recommendations vary from municipality to municipality, or are these broad recommendations that can help all of them?
Certainly, there's many of these recommendations that are broad, but within each of these, the characteristics of individual municipalities are so unique that there does need to be some customization in terms of how these municipalities are adopting the recommendations or applying state-level policy change to meet the needs of the residents in their communities.
In our last minute, how was the pandemic a wake-up call for some municipalities? What did they realize they needed to do to weather maybe another potential storm?
The pandemic has certainly been had significant impacts in terms of revenues to local governments, but it also has had some silver linings. And so, for instance, for many municipalities, because of social distancing measures, they've now had to invest more in terms of the technology they use to allow for remote work and paperless offices and remote council meetings as well. And I think that the American Rescue Plan also offers a unique opportunity for municipalities to try to identify investments in their communities to help them in the long term as well.
Aaron Lauer is a senior policy analyst at the University of Pittsburgh's Institute of Politics. We'll have a link to their report on our website, WESA.FM. Aaron, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. We've been asking families for questions, those very good questions that a kiddo in your life might have, but leave you scratching your head. We're turning to an expert today for some help with one of these. Ainsley Seago is the Associate Curator of Invertebrate Zoology at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. In the U.S., there are more than 30,000 kinds of beetles. Around the globe, that number jumps to 350,000, making them one of the largest groups of animals. This question comes from Natalie. They want to know, can beetles walk backwards? So, Ainsley.
The first beetles that would come to mind as being very good at walking backwards would be the dung beetles. If you think about that classic sort of nature documentary image of a big old dung beetle rolling a ball of dung backwards across the African desert, they are pretty good at it, but when you actually look at them closely, they're not quite walking backwards. Their two hind legs are resting on the dung ball, and in order to roll it, those two hind legs are walking forwards, while the front pair of legs is walking backwards. Whether or not you would qualify that as truly simply walking backwards is another question. Some insects are really good at this. Things like ants and wasps that are hunting large prey that's going to be something heavy they need to drag back to their nest, they're extremely good at it. Most beetles that you'd see out walking around in your backyard or the park wouldn't really have a situation where they need to walk backwards. They would simply, if they came into a sort of a cul-de-sac or found themselves trapped, they would simply rear up on their hind legs and turn around that way. It's like kind of turning around your car by driving it up on the wall. One of the ways that beetles are arguably a lot better at efficient locomotion than we are. But when you think about beetles that live in something like a tunnel, a very tight tunnel that they fit into tightly, they do need to move backwards. And so I took a look in the scientific literature, and I was able to find at least one documented video of a different species of beetle that can, in fact, walk backwards.
It's not that beetles can't walk backwards. is that they have no need to walk backwards.
Insects are, you can think of them almost as little robots. They're made of rigid parts that interlock to provide flexibility, and they have very simple motor programs that tell them how to get through and move around in the world. And if you have a species like a ground beetle that's out running around on the ground, that's the family Carabidae, you would not be able to induce them to walk backwards. There are some things like stick insects where you can in fact induce them to walk backwards by gently tugging on their antennae. They will only do it under duress. However, if you look at, for example, the coffeeberry borer beetle, Hypothenemus hampii, these guys are so small they can form a huge colony inside a single coffee berry. That's the little fruit the bean comes from. And some researchers who wanted to study their behavior created an artificial environment for them to live inside that could be sandwiched between two plates of glass so they could actually watch them moving around in their tunnels. And these guys can and do walk backwards because there is a tunnel that they live in that is the exact size and width of their body, so they need to be able to go backwards because there's literally no other way to turn around.
So if a kid comes across a beetle that's stuck in a corner in duress, what would you recommend that they do to help the beetle get out of that situation?
Well, if you watch the beetle, what it's most likely to do is it's going to rear up on its hind legs, resting its front legs on the wall or on the corner itself, and it'll simply stand up in its back legs and turn around and come down facing the correct direction, or the direction that it wants to be. Although, many beetles will simply turn, face the wall, and begin walking directly up the wall because their feet are covered with tiny little brushes that helps them stick to even surfaces that we would consider pretty slippery. If you find a beetle in duress, it might be a beetle who's flipped over on its back and needs some help turning over, though. And in that case, you can usually just take a little twig and gently flip them over, give them a little boost.
Ainsley Seago is the Associate Curator of Invertebrate Zoology at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. If a kid in your life has a good question, send it to confluence@wesa.fm.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Next time, the increase in fraud and unemployment claims is causing states to shore up their technological infrastructure. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Rebecca Reese, Owen Trainer, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.